The subject I wanted to talk about tonight is about emptiness and language, and possibly a little bit on the idea of what's in Buddhism called the two truths. We've been having discussions over the last few days in the small groups that are kind of an exploration of the different kinds of concepts that we use and how those concepts and views shape our perceptions, the directions that we see things in life. And some of the ideas that I want to discuss tonight are also concepts that I think can have a strong impact in shaping how we view our lives. However, the Buddha once said that talking about emptiness in a mistaken way is a little like holding a snake. And I actually, when the retreat started, I had a dream one night where I was watching a snake open up a little box that a frog jumped out on, and the snake twisted around the frog. And I was looking at it, and I thought, I'll help this frog out. So I poked the snake and grabbed the So the frog got away, and I grabbed the snake. And then as I picked up the snake and holding it, I realized, what am I going to do with this? And I sort of feel like that's about where I am in giving this talk tonight. That dream was very prophetic. So... Actually, there's another way to begin this talk. This is a kind of a story about emptiness, where there's a man who's living out in a house by a river, and some of you might have even heard this story. The river is rising, and the waters are flowing up, and as they reach his front porch, a rowboat comes down, and people say, "Get in! The water is going to rise. You're going to drown. Your house is going to be covered. Get in. We'll save you." And the man says, "That's okay. I believe in God." So the rowboat passes by, and the water rises, and he climbs up on the second level. He's on up in the second level, and the water comes up, and another rowboat comes by and says, "Get in, the water's coming, you're going to drown. This is this is a chance to escape." And he says, "It's okay, I believe in God." So the man climbs up on the chimney, and the water rises up there, and he's right up to here on him, it's his waist, and a helicopter comes by, and it throws down a ladder and says, "Climb on, we'll save you." He says, "That's okay, I believe in God." So the water comes up over the roof, over the chimney. The man drowns and goes to heaven. And he goes up into heaven, and he asks to go speak to God, and he says, "I don't get it. I believe in you. How come you let me drown?" And God says, "Well, I sent two rowboats and a helicopter." So... Somewhere tonight, that story will relate to what I'm saying. I guess it's emptiness and language, to get back to the original idea. That, what is the idea of emptiness? And there's a lot of different ways of talking about emptiness, but emptiness is a concept that means basically, it's very much related to the idea in Buddhism of dependent arising. And I sort of talked about this the other night, that that every thing that we define as a thing is in some way related to or defined by something else. And and went over it in really simple ways. You look at the outlines of something, and it's always contrasted against something else, and that, you know, who we are as human beings is very related to the oxygen we breathe, which is very related to the trees, and that all things are interrelated and mutually defining in that way, that nothing has its own existence, that it exists in a completely separate way from other things. And that the idea of emptiness has a tremendous potential as a guiding idea or a guiding concept in terms of freeing us from the idea of things being separate, ourselves being separate, that our illusions of separateness and isolation and substantiality of things being completely existing on their own is in some way an illusion. That things are relative, that exist in a relative way. And I think I even mentioned in the other talk the idea of applying emptiness to language in the sense that the words that we speak, and even the way we use words, we usually, in order to have some kind of meaning, are using one word, and it's to get its meaning or an understanding of it, it refers to something else. I think I even read some little Zen poems, but I like them so much, I'm going to read more Zen poems tonight. His pull and bind the sheaves of grass together, and there's a grass hut. Untie them, and there's the original field. It's the idea that things are relative, they depend on each other. Another one. Horse dung originates in the pampas grass on the hills and fields which once gave shelter to chirping grasshoppers. And the ship depends on a sail, the sail depends on the wind, I, a merchant, depend on customers. It's the idea of the dependent. Even in terms of the language that we use, just to define whatever it is that we want to get across, we need to often speak in terms of something else. For example, just the idea of how we talk about our feelings. Are you feeling up or down? Are you feeling light or heavy? Is it feeling having to do with lightness or weight, using weight in terms of feeling? Or in terms of relationships, our relationship is on the rocks. Or, you know, we're really enjoying a smooth journey together. Just that when we speak usually from comparing one thing to another. So the emptiness, language has a certain kind of emptiness to it in that it only seems to take meaning, or it seems to have meaning for us when you define one thing in terms of another. If I, for example, if you came into a warehouse and we had in our warehouse no understanding at all of the word cup, even though there was a cup hanging on the wall, but I had no idea of using the word cup, and you came up to me and just said, cup, 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 I would just look at you and just not understand what you were talking about. So it usually define it in terms of something else to get the meaning across. So what's the next step with this in terms of this idea of relative meaning, emptiness, language? Where can that go in terms of what we've been talking about? to relate it one step further, there's a profound idea or concept in Buddhism called the idea of the two truths. And the Buddha even went so far as to say, not to invoke the Buddha as an authority figure, but the Buddha went even so far as to say, it's very important now, that if you don't understand the two truths, it's going to be hard to understand my teaching. It's very profound. The true truths have to do with the idea of the relative truth and the ultimate truth. And this, I will relate this back also to language too. But the idea of the relative truth is kind of what I've talked about already, the idea of how things depend on each other, dependent origination. That, as Thich Nhat Hanh once said, the Buddhist story of Genesis is this is this because that's that. That's the Buddhist story of Genesis. So, the relative truth is that things exist in a relative way, that we only know one thing in terms of another, that in terms of our language and developing meaning, that I only know what the word car is because I know what the word road means, or because I know what driving means, or that kind of thing. Or I know what love is because I know what hate is. We kind of went through that, the unity, the relationship of the opposites to define each other. So in that sense that things exist in a relative way, and especially in terms of how we use language, then when we talk, most of the time we're talking in a relative way. We're talking about one thing in terms of another. Even though it seems like sometimes there's a kind of absolute to our experience. It really seems like there is only one way to talk about something. I can't give you an example of that right away, but if any time you've really been stuck in a sense of strong suffering, that's probably a good time to look at how you're, if you're getting caught in a view. That's an example of an absolutizing a view. There's only one way to see the situation, the current way. So, if that's the case, what are we talking about when we talk about nirvana or enlightenment or liberation or mostly the ultimate truth, something that is beyond this relative way of perceiving, this relative way of talking. And the ultimate truth is, of course, defined by the relative truth. That the ultimate truth is if things are just defined by distinctions, relative distinctions, this is this because that's that, then the ultimate truth is no distinction. Of course, what's that? Because if I'm saying that there's no distinctions, in other words, talking about something that has no distinctions, meaning there's a sense of unity or unification in some sense, but even that, even saying no distinctions, is again a kind of distinction, right? I mean, I have to have distinctions and I have no distinctions. It seems kind of abstract, but I'll bring it into a more specific idea. So, the idea of the ultimate truth is that it is depends on a relative truth. Our idea of no distinctions or no distinctiveness is in some way related to the idea of distinctions. And in fact, that's a really kind of important tool that, and I think we even mentioned this in the group, somebody was mentioning in terms of their practice, that in some way the kinds of extremes of practice, the extremes of suffering, say, or the sense of self at times, or the sense of something being very clear, and the sense of something and perception being very unclear, it was through those extremes that this person came to see the lack of extremes. It's kind of like I mentioned, I think someone, that I once went to a physical therapist who had on her door the sign that said, the truth will set you free, but first it will probably make you miserable. That's kind of that sense that the extremes, it's going through extremes often that we realize that the extremes aren't extremes. It's through the distinctions that we realize there's no distinction, really, where we thought there had been one. So it's this idea of the ultimate is not something that we can really talk about, except as I'm talking about it now, except in terms of the relative. And then you might think, so what? I mean, big deal. What does that mean? And this is a really good question. That's why I told the story about the snake. Because you're really holding a snake. If you believe that emptiness or the ultimate truth is referring to something other than how we're talking about it. And yet, there's a sense that probably each of us has had of this sense of no distinction in some way. So, I have to look at another poem here. Okay, this is the idea. All right, so they have this idea of the relative truth, the ultimate truth, the idea of emptiness. Okay, and relating this idea now to language, taking these ideas and relating them to language. Something I've noticed also in the conversations I've had in groups in terms of how I've experienced my meditation or spirituality, Dharma practice, my life, other people, how they've experienced their lives. There's a way in which, at times, it seems as if the language that I'm using or the way that I'm talking really does refer to something other than the way that I'm talking and the language that I'm using. It really seems as if somehow language is pointing beyond itself. Interesting way to talk. But it's like saying, and not to say, again, not to say that this way of talking is right or wrong, not to say it's good or bad, it's just a kind of observation about how we often use language and how we often talk. Where it seems like, maybe you've heard comments like this where, you know, I'm meditating and suddenly I go beyond thinking to something other than thinking. Or I have thoughts and then I just have images. Or there's a long period of silence where no thoughts are happening. Or I have thoughts and then I have my emotions. And my emotions are much different than my thoughts in some way. And in making that division between the language and something else, I'm using the language in a really compelling way. I'm, in a sense, hypnotizing myself to believe that there's what I'm saying and that there's something other than what I'm saying. Even though I'm talking about it, I'm defining it right now by how I'm talking. Well, that's an incredible feat. That's an amazing feat because it sets up the possibility now for there to be other dimensions of experience which are removed from what I've just said about them. That somehow they exist independently of the language that I use. And yet I experience them. And here I'm, if you notice how I'm talking, I'm using the words experience, other dimensions to how I talk or language. I'm using language to define all of this. I'm using words. But at the same time, it seems as if there's something else there. Relative, absolute. Talking relatively about something that's beyond the way I'm talking. Something that's absolutely there. And I guess the reason I'm bringing this up is looking at the history of religion at times, or the history of human conflict, a very common pattern is to invoke or explain the reason that one does something is because of something greater and beyond oneself, what one is saying, due to the unconscious, it's due to God, it's due to something or other that is beyond what I'm talking about. It's an appeal to another kind of authority. Experience, the unconscious, my emotional life. Not to say that those things do or do not exist. They exist obviously in a relative way because I'm talking about them and I'm giving them a kind of life and talking about them. But soon it's possible to start to believing to such an extent in the existence and absolute divinity of this something else that you forget that you started to talk about it and gave it life by talking about it. So what happens is you become bewitched by concepts of things that are outside of language in some way. And those concepts become so fixed that they have a sacred position in our lives. Can't be questioned. And in fact, if you do question them, there's something wrong with you. If you think that my idea of God is not right, well, I have no choice but to punish you. I mean, it's obvious. God gives me messages. I know. Or something gives me, you fill in the blank. So the reason I'm bringing it up is it's a kind of, as the philosopher Wittgenstein said, it's a kind of bewitchment of our intelligence by language. That we set up some kind of absolute quality that is controlling us, my will, whatever it might be. Perhaps one of the greatest absolute qualities that is controlling us is me, the sense of me, that in some way I, as an entity, absolutely exist. I have a real foundation, completely outside of this conventional term that I use, I, to refer to myself. Massive hypnosis. Not that these terms don't have a very practical, conventional usage. And of course, the way in which day-to-day life is lived and day-to-day understandings and agreements are made is through this language. But it's a relative way of talking that can quickly seem to become absolute in some way. It can quickly seem to, it seems as if the words really refer to something that's absolutely there and is not defined dependently with the language that's used to talk about them. So, kind of like the idea of God, I guess coming back to the story, the robots, it's almost a little like the belief in God, you know, God's going to save me, the two robots and a helicopter show up, and you know, of course, that's not God. It's that idea between the absolute version of God and a relative version of God, and God saying, you know, there I was. So if that's the case, what can you do about that? I mean, what kind of understanding am I talking about in terms of, in relationship to language, language use? The whole process of inquiry and understanding, the whole concept of wisdom, how to make use of this idea of the two truths and of emptiness. Well, one of the key things is not to think of emptiness as a thing. Emptiness is a way we have of talking about relating our concepts to each other. It's not anything. It's about how we talk about relating. So it's a tool for understanding that. And the second thing is to inspect this idea of when you actually believe in something being either real or not real. Because either way, there's a setup through language of something that seems to have its own existence. And you forget it's a way you have of talking that sets this idea up. And the third part of this actually, there were two parts actually before this. Just made that up right now. If this idea of the absolute truth is something, this idea of some kind of non-distinction, a kind of, as it were, way of embracing, it would have to, this idea of non-distinctions would have to include, by definition, all the distinctions. Right? So you can't just say that this idea of non-distinction is oneness, because once you talk about oneness, of course, as Woody Allen said, I mentioned this before, I think, Woody Allen said, once those students who have mastered oneness will go on to two-ness. Or... someone else said something. Great, another Woody Allen line. That's how I mentioned it. If nothing exists, this rug sure cost me a lot of money. So, taking this idea of non-distinction, we all know what that means. You can think of the two truths as a kind of ladder where you start out on a relative notion of things, you use it to climb up to the idea of an ultimate notion, and when you get up to the ultimate notion, you realize that that's not something that's really there in the sense that you think it's there, because it's depending on the relative. You climb back down the ladder to the relative again, and you realize that the relative is not there because the ultimate wasn't there either. I hope that makes sense. And like I said, it's really like holding a snake. But, you know, it makes sense in a certain way. Of course, what that way is, I just have no way of telling you. And this has been the perennial problem with this conversation. So, but does anybody have an idea of what I'm talking about? Perhaps some idea. Well, this is where I really want to bring in some of these Zen poems again. My philosophy at this point is, when in doubt, bring in the Zen poems. And undoubtedly some Zen master would hear this talk and just, you know, have ended it long ago with the gong. Okay, so we've climbed up the ladder. And now we've climbed back down the ladder. And it's time for tea. Okay. So I find that at that, juncture, as it were, there's a way in which, you know, I really come back to poetry, because there's something about poetry where poetry in some ways is no longer attempting to explain anything. It's just saying it in the way that, you know, when you play an instrument, you're just playing the music. Or even right now as I'm talking, and as you probably have a sense throughout most of this talk, I really have no idea what I'm going to say. And practically no sense of what I'm talking about. Although it seems to make sense at the time, in a relative way. Okay. Here's one of those poems. Kind of what happens is that this understanding doesn't really do anything, because it's not an understanding about doing something. That would, not ultimately. But relatively, it, as an expression in America, I don't know if you ever hear it, it takes the edge off. It takes the edge off in the sense of there being a completely clear, defined edge to everything in an absolute way. It gives us a sense that when we're talking, we're talking. When we're not talking, we're not talking. It's very Zen, you know, when you're hungry, you're eating. Zen poem. A heavy snowfall disappears into the sea. What silence. In spring, flowers, summer, cuckoos, autumn, moon, in winter, snow is chilling and cool. All heaven and earth have worked out this single buttercup. Surely it will go on, age after age. And here's a great understanding of that sense of the two truths. My body is given up, cast away, zero. But on snowy nights, I feel chilly. Again, a sense of the relative mixed with the absolute. Does the moon slip by with no intention? It's a message warning that your life is passing. Sort of in the sense that when you give up on the fixation on the absolute truth of things, and knowing it, having it, I don't know, what else you want to do with it? Cooking with it? Beating people over the head with it? Beating yourself over the head with it? There's a sense of being, again, in the scheme of things, in the language of relativity, or in the language of talking, in which what we do is what we do, what we say is what we say, what we experience is what we experience. And that's what, you know, can be said about it, and probably a whole lot more. And I think that the kind of simplicity in that, there can be a kind of simplicity in that understanding, and also it's a means of not getting too caught up in any view as if it had an ultimate basis to it, as if it had a, it was really going to be the bottom line. And, you know, looking around the world, this world is just driven insane by absolute views of how everything should be. I mean, people are at war with each other. People are kind of from an absolute perspective here. Well, people are really driven mad by their concepts, in a sense. The kinds of things that we do to prove the ultimacy of our beliefs. It reminds me a little bit of this sign in Berkeley, a town known for its the Bay Area, San Francisco, known for its liberal tradition in some way, or radical. Somebody put out a great poster saying, "Everything that is not prohibited is mandatory." Ordinance 1984, put out by the Committee for Totalitarian Thought. That's kind of the two truths there. In the ultimate form. It's another great, one of these great Buddhist texts, talking about the going through this whole kind of rigmarole that just went through, talking about the two truths and the impact and proving, you know, the non-existence of this and the existence of that and this and that and this and that and not this and that and so on. So they're in the form of a dialogue, and at the end, the question is asked, how is it then that things seem to be caused by other things? Why does one thing appear to be caused by another? You know, how can we explain it, basically? And the reply is, it's just that one thing appears to be caused by another. What else is there to say? Well, I think I'll finish up with a few little other poems. And it's great, another Japanese emperor, Goyozi, I think his name is, being asked a question by one of the Zen teachers. Smiling eyebrows are opened. Is it cherry or peach blossom? And the reply is, who does not know, yet nobody knows. Although I came this way to beg food, I've spent the time picking violets in the spring field. Over the pond every night, the moon casts its light, but the water won't be soiled, and the moon won't be either. The two truths, you know, the relative and the appearance, and yet the non-ultimacy of the appearance. That's why, actually, when you hear these statements, some of the Buddhist teachings, samsara or illusion. One of the great sages in early Buddhism, Nagarjuna, says at the end of this long treatise explaining everything by this idea of the two truths, saying, samsara has nothing that distinguishes it from nirvana, the relative and the ultimate. Nirvana has nothing that distinguishes it from samsara. The limit of nirvana is the limit of samsara. There's not even the subtlest something separating them. So, just kind of that non-striving, that no distinction. However, don't let any of this talk dissuade you from working harder in your practice. And again, remember, if it's misunderstood incorrectly, it can be like a snake. And I don't know, some of you might have handled snakes, or you do that regularly, I don't know. But I guess that's about it.